member of WildGamesProductions.com and D20Radio.com. You burst through the door, you find a small room filled with gold and jewels, and a red dragon. He starts to breathe. Save or die!
Welcome to the Save or Die Podcast, a podcast about classic Dungeons & Dragons. If it's in a box, we'll talk about it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Save or Die Podcast. I am DM Vince, along with DM Crispy, and we're sitting in with famed author and creator of the Dragonlance series, Tracy Hickman. Hello, Mr. Hickman. How are you doing today?
Doing very well today. Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
We're glad you're here, too. And we have a lot of questions for you today from various people, but I just wanted to start off with one question in, relating to Dragonlance and how you and Laura had created Dragonlance, about the story.
Certainly.
Of how you were sitting in the car driving to meet with Gary, I guess, for maybe the first or second time, and you had this idea of Dragonlance and how you concepted it in the car on the way.
Well, we did. I'd had my interview, and at the time I'd been out of work for, I believe, about 6 months. The last time we had a recession, though, I don't think it was anywhere near as bad as what we've been going through these days.
Yeah.
But the wife and I were living, if you can think of it in those terms, in Logan, Utah. We couldn't get any work. And I actually had applied for a bus driving position at the university campus. And I was one of 500 applicants for that particular job.
Wow.
I came in second, which, by the way, doesn't get you anything.
No.
certainly doesn't get you the bus driving job. And I just couldn't make a living there. We'd had a game store, actually, there, and I had been manager of a theater, a movie theater at the time up there, and lost the job, shut down the game store. I just couldn't make ends meet. And, in fact, we were living off of church welfare at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't actually afford to buy shoes for my children that winter. We couldn't go to church because we didn't have any shoes for the kids. So in an effort to buy shoes for my kids that winter, we had heard actually that TSR Incorporated, the creators of the Dungeons & Dragons game, would pay $500 for an adventure module.
Wow.
And my wife and I, on our own, had written a couple of modules. We'd written Rahasia and Pharaoh, and had published them ourselves, assembling them on our little card table in our kitchen, and taking them to a local butcher shop to have them shrink-wrapped. That was the way we had those done then.
Neat.
But we sent those adventures to TSR, submitted them to them in the hopes that they would buy pay enough money for them so that we could buy shoes for the kids that winter. As it turns out, a very good, a legendary game designer, actually, Michael Gray, who is, I believe he's a vice president now at Hasbro, had seen our adventure modules for sale in a local hobby shop and picked one up and was very impressed with it. So when we had submitted these adventures, he took them to management and said, "We need to hire this guy. We don't need to just buy his stuff. We need to hire this guy." So they called me up and said, "Can we offer you a job?" You know, and I had nothing else to do.
Right.
So they flew us. They flew me out actually to Wisconsin, I interviewed. And had a really good interview there. They took me to the Playboy Club, which was at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which was, for this rather conservative Christian, was an interesting journey. But at least, you know, I get to say that now.
Yeah.
But I was actually there back when they existed.
This was the early 80s, right?
Yeah, this was the early 80s, okay. About 80, I think it was 81, 82.
Okay.
And so I interviewed there and flew back home. They called me up with an offer for the job a few days later. And they actually had to call me on our neighbor's telephone because the phone in our apartment had had been disconnected. That's how far down we'd gone.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, so my parents, my parents called again on the neighbor's phone and begged me not to go do this thing. Not to take this job as a game designer. They said, you've pretty much failed at everything so far, son. And and if you go out there and fail, we just won't be able to bring you back. So, you know, the offer actually that they made to me, the counteroffer that they made to me was that I could come down to Flagstaff, live in their basement, and he was pretty sure he could get me a job at the local Sizzler.
Oh, wow.
And that was my choice, live in my dad's basement and work at the Sizzler or go to Wisconsin and work as a game designer.
Hmm.
And that was, you know, that took a minute to decide where I was going to go.
Yeah, I figured.
So we did. We packed up our what few belongings that we had in a moving van and sent them on its way across the country. My wife and I packed our then two small children in the back of our Volkswagen Rabbit and headed across the plains the other way. Yeah, most of my ancestors came west, and we were the first ones to go back east. And, you know, it was a long drive from Utah to Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and the plains of Nebraska being what they are, here we were heading out, and actually, to a certain extent, with the sound of my father's voice in my head, fearing failure, as we traveled across the country, my wife and I discussed what could we possibly bring to TSR Incorporated that would justify them actually paying us money to write games. And it was there, actually, crossing the plains of Nebraska, that we talked about this world of riders on the backs of dragons and the great war that they would fight and the course of the war. And it was there that Dragonlance was born, somewhere outside of Ogallala, Nebraska, I believe.
Wow.
You know, the origins of things are one never knows. One never knows when something great is going to be sprung out of some seed. And I think that that's as true today as it was back then. It's always fascinating to me to see new talent that comes up and has a new idea. And, you know, sometimes those seeds fall in kind of rocky ground and just don't take flight. But every now and then they take hold, and it's a glorious thing when it does.
I tell you, Dragonlance has been embraced very, very well with the community as far as the setting and the novels. And I mean, people always talk about Dragonlance wherever I go. So,
well, and it's the one calling card that I can, you know, people ask me what I do for a living sometimes. Uh-huh. I say, well, I'm a novelist. And then the next question is, of course, oh, have you written anything I've read?
Uh-huh. Yeah,
which is a tough question to answer, by the way, because I don't know what they've read.
Yeah.
But usually if I'll mention Dragonlance, they will know. They will have heard of it or know someone who has read it. Every now and then, that seems to be the calling card that people most recognize.
Yeah, of course. The first thing you think about when you think of Dragonlance is Tracy Hickman, Laura Hickman, and Margaret Weiss.
Well, I hope so. Certainly,
yeah.
It's been a tremendous thing in our lives to be part of all of that. And of course, when we say that, and when people say, "Yeah," when they mention Dragonlance, they think of Margaret and they think of Laura and they think of me.
Right.
But when they say that, they in some ways do a disservice to a lot of people who contributed to this. There have been a lot of people who have contributed, of course, in the novel lines over the years. But also at the time, back at TSR, there were many, many designers and artists who contributed tremendously to Dragonlance in those early days. And who often get unheralded, I think, when people talk about Dragonlance.
I believe Douglas Niles wrote a various bunch of novels for Dragonlance, if I remember correctly.
He did, and he also wrote a number of really fine adventures for Dragonlance. He was in on the creative team that worked through Dragonlance in those in the early days when we were putting it all together. Dave Cook, of course, also contributed. Yep. Jeff Grubb contributed hugely.
Yeah.
To Dragonlance back in those early days. Jeff was a go-to kind of a guy who was there throughout the creative process in terms of the adventure, and he wrote a lot of the adventures himself as well. He's underestimated, I think, when it comes to Dragonlance.
I have to say, Jeff Grubb is like the jack of all trades of TSR. He has his hand and helped in almost everything you could think about what they produced back then. Just an amazing writer he is.
Well, he was a tremendous talent.
Yeah.
Still is a tremendous talent in terms of game design and anything that he puts his hand to. I think of him as, when I think about Jeff, who has been a really great friend of mine down the years, when I think of Jeff, I think of someone who is a tremendous craftsman and who applies that craft beautifully to everything that he does.
Yes, he said when I interviewed him from another show that we were doing, I sat and talked with him after the show about he was designing Guild Wars, the game, the second one.
Yes,
he explained a little bit of what he could tell me, and I was just like, "Wow!" He's like, "Oh, that's all I did in the last week so far." I'm like, "Okay, wow." I mean, obviously, I wasn't allowed to say anything about it, but it was just amazing what he told me about the game, and I can't wait for it to come out. So,
oh yeah, he is a tremendous talent, and not only a tremendous talent, but a fabulous person to work with, and a great guy to know.
Oh yeah,
and a first-rate gamer. Yeah, Jeff's a great man. I love him.
Cool, Crispy. You have any questions?
Yeah, I've got one from Thorkhammer on Dragon's Foot.
All right.
He would like to know, some folks love Dragonlance and all its elaborateness. Some dislike it equally for the same reason. Fence sitters and chips. Fence sitters are chimps and need to be knocked out of the tree.
Okay.
Are you totally pleased with how it turned out? And was there anything about how it evolved that you regret or wish you had done differently?
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of things I wish that I'd done differently. But I don't think that you can really go back and change any of that. And we look back now, both Margaret and I have looked back at the original Dragonlance novel, for example. And when Dragonlance was first written, you need to understand that Dragonlance was actually supposed to be a stopgap product. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be the thing that we did until the next big thing came along.
You were.
And they had a number of top-notch people working on the next big thing at the time. Yeah, I don't know what it was. If you do, I don't know what it was.
But, no.
Dragonlance became the next big thing. And as we were working on it, it was the first time, really, that we had attempted to tell an epic story through game. That anybody actually had attempted to do that. And so we were pioneering techniques that had never been attempted or done before. And one of those techniques involved the relationship actually between an adventure module and a story, which we didn't understand until we got into it. So we started writing Dragonlance. We started writing the adventures because, of course, from our perspective as a game company, writing the adventures was where all of the money was. That's what we understood. And so we started writing the adventures, and I wrote the first adventure, and I believe Doug wrote the second, and then I think I wrote the third. And so we started to do the adventures first and write the adventures first and sell them first. So then we wanted to do the books. And the books were, you know, kind of lumped in there with tertiary product. There were plans for a Tiamat wind-up toy, for example, and beach towels, you know, and certainly miniatures, which made a whole lot more sense than the other two to me. But novels were just kind of lumped in there as something else that we would do. Mm-hmm. We did have a book division at the time, and Gene Raby was in charge of it. Which is another story, by the way, as to how we got to write those books. But the books we started writing after the adventure modules. And we found... actually, and when we think about the original books now, we look at those and we have way too many characters in the book. I mean, it's great for a party of adventurers, and it seems like a well-balanced party of adventurers for a D&D game. But when we started writing him in the book, we were all marching around like a tour group. You know, everyone was following the flag, and we'd all march over to Zoxaroth, romp, 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 romp. And then we'd go over there. Oh, it's time to go back to Solos. And then we all get together behind the flag and romp, 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 romp. We'd march over there. And it was unwieldy in terms of story, and it also made this and it was difficult to tell the story that way because, truthfully, Adventure Module makes for not terribly good story. Mm. And so what happened then is that we were able to write novels faster than we could produce the game adventures and put them on market. So after we got through the fourth Adventure Module, we found ourselves writing the second book in the series ahead of the adventure modules. And that worked out ever so much better because writing adventures to story was a lot easier than writing story to the adventure. So, you know, we actually had considered it, Margaret had considered at least at one point rewriting the first trilogy. Because when we wrote those first books, we were very young in the craft, and we hadn't had as much experience then as we do now. But on reflection, you know, I said, you know, we can't do that. Dragonlance Chronicles is a classic for people now.
It's the most recommended book if you ask anyone. I know when I first started reading novels, I was like, what book should I read? People like Dragonlance, the first set. That's what everybody always told me.
And what a tremendous compliment that is to those books. And so were they the best written books in the world? Not with the craft that we know now, but that makes no difference whatsoever.
No.
That they are what they are, and that people love them is a wonderful thing, and I'm grateful for that. So I think maybe I'll just leave that, you know, at that. Okay. But would I have changed things? Absolutely. Could we have done things better or if we did them differently? In hindsight, I think that's true of everything. Mm. But would I trade my life right now for anything else? I don't think so.
The Sizzler job?
Not for the Sizzler job, most certainly.
You could have you could have made manager.
Yeah, dude.
I could have been manager. You maybe even been like a big store.
District manager by now.
District man, no, I've got dreams, but please.
Yeah. Tracy Hickman, district manager.
Yeah, you know, and what a sad thing that would have been to have missed out on the life that I've been living now had I taken that other road, had I not taken that chance at the time.
It's amazing when you look back at things like that.
It is. And what a wonderful thing that we went through the pain at the time. You know, we're going through painful times right now, I think, pretty much everyone. The world's in terrible turmoil at the moment. And people are tired of being oppressed and told what to do, both abroad and here at home.
Yeah.
We find ourselves in bondage to our own economy. Mm-hmm. And we are being shouted at from all sides by strange voices, all of which are counseling us to hate. I've received emails over the last 2 days, one from a liberal action group and one from a conservative action group, okay. Neither of whom said anything substantive, but both of whom were beating drums and shouting at the great evil that they were trying to bring down that had absolutely nothing to do with the problem or the argument. Neither one of them solved a thing.
Right.
But they both wanted me to send the money. we live in difficult times, and I think that it's important for us to remember that hard times come to an end. They don't last forever. And that, yeah, we can still dream. We can still do something valuable and move forward.
True. You got to go through the rough times to get to the good times.
You do, and sometimes the good times spring out of those rough times. Our life back in the early 80s, where we were so dirt poor and couldn't find work, forced us eventually to this better destiny for us. And I can't really begrudge time that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I have another question for you. This comes from Game, sure. Game Ogre from the Dragon's Foot Forum. He wants to know what's next. 4E, Pathfinder? No other system that I know of could afford to do Dragonlance, or could they? Could you make your own system for Dragonlance? I'm unsure of what hold WotC, etc. has over Dragonlance. Please fill us in.
Oh, I'd be happy to do the best that I can. Dragonlance is a trademark of Hasbro Incorporated,
yeah.
And is used here without their permission. When we submitted our work, when we were working at TSR, we were under agreement that anything that we produced there was owned by the company, mm-hmm. and that we had no copyright claim on it whatsoever. Every Dragonlance book that Margaret and I have written, or for that matter that anybody else has written, have all been done under work for hire contracts. And so as a consequence of this, Wizards of the Coast, or Hasbro, however you want to look at it, owns Dragonlance in total. Very often people will come to me and say, well, I'd like to do this project in Dragonlance, or why don't you do this in Dragonlance, or couldn't you make this in Dragonlance? Margaret was able for a short period of time to do that by getting a license from Wizards of the Coast to produce Dragonlance, but they've since rescinded that.
Right.
And actually, it was unilateral on their part. They just simply said that they were taking back the license. They wanted to retire the brand. Would I like to do more Dragonlance? Oh, sure, absolutely. Would I? I have a trilogy in mind, actually. To write for Dragonlance that is very exciting and I think would be a fabulous thing to do. But they have other plans over at Wizards of the Coast, and I guess I'll just leave them to that. They own it, and so what happens with it is pretty much under their control. I have no say. Margaret has no say in what goes on there. As for other systems, well, sure, you could always do another system. And in fact, my son and I wrote a game book a couple of years ago called XDM Extreme Dungeon Mastery.
Yeah.
Yes, I remember seeing the commercials for them. They were hilarious.
And the game's hilarious. You guys should take a look at that, and I should probably send one over to you.
Oh, yeah.
It's, yeah, I could do that. I'm not a bad guy. Yeah, and in fact, it's out right now. Not only can you buy it on the Extreme Dungeon Mastery website, but now it's available on Kindle.
Oh, really? Cool. Huh.
Yeah, on Kindles and Nooks, in EPUB and in Mobi formats. So now you can like download it immediately and participate in the nonsense. But we actually produced a role playing game.
Right.
As part of the Extreme Dungeon Mastery book, the XDM, we call the XD20 system, with a tongue firmly in our cheek, which, interestingly enough, has become the preferred gaming system of a lot of people. They wrote to us, they've written to us since, you know, this is all I play now because this is a blast. This is fun. And, okay. That's really good news. So I don't know. Maybe I could recommend the XD20 system from Extreme Dungeon Mastery as the new Dragonlance standard.
If you happen to get the license back for some reason, it just happened to fall.
If for some reason the license happens to fall back in my lap, the odds of that are pretty remote.
0.0.
How does zero sound?
Yeah that sounds just about right.
Yeah. Or nigh unto. You probably, you know, I'm a hopeful guy, so, you know, I'll say nigh unto zero is probably more accurate. Because there, you know, who knows? Something odd could happen. But, it's a world that we love very much. So, yeah, we could do Extreme Dungeon Mastery in XD20 system for Dragonlance. And I think, actually, it'd be a lot of fun.
Is there anything in any of the contracts to say that if WotC or Hasbro brings it back, they have to consult you on anything? Or it's up to them because they own it? Too bad.
It's up to them.
Yeah.
If they want Dale Brown to write the next Dragonlance book, I guess that's up to them. Or Dan Brown, excuse me.
Yeah.
That's pretty much up to them. And It's been an interesting journey down through the years because Margaret and I, when we left the company, and when I left the company and Laura left, and left with me, of course, then they decided to do Dragonlance on their own, and it became messed up to a great extent. They divided the market. They divided the product. They split their own market. And then TSR was then sold to Wizards of the Coast.
Right.
And bless his heart, the owner of Wizards of the Coast, Peter Adkison came out to TSR, and one of the things that he said in the meeting in front of everybody was, "And who screwed up Dragonlance?"
Nice.
And Elizabeth Baldwin, Margaret's daughter, was there at the time, and she raised her hand. She said, "That would be my mother, sir." And in fact, it was not her mother. It was, in fact, what the company had done with the product. And so one of the first things that, next thing I knew, Peter was on the phone to me apologizing for saying anything stupid at this meeting. And I had no idea what he'd said. Nobody told me. So I said, "Well, don't worry about it at all, Peter. We think the world of you." And so the next thing we knew, we were invited back in because Peter respected us. And we were invited back in to fix Dragonlance. That's when we came back in and we did
some more amazing books.
I did a whole new set of books and brought the series back together and reunified all of the people and then after we had repaired it and gotten everything working again and everything was very happy with the direction it was taking, then they dumped us again and we were gone. Peter was gone from the company and they decided they didn't need us anymore. So we were on the outs again. So we've been in and out of the door at Wizards of the Coast down through the years. I know it doesn't make much sense to people when they hear that. But, you know, I suppose at the time, corporate-wise, it probably made sense to them.
Yeah. I have a feeling that you will be contacted for E. I just have that big feeling going on.
A lovely thought, but yeah. Somehow I think that they will, their first initial reaction usually is that we know better how to fix it, and we don't need to pay anybody to fix it. But then maybe they'll come back. I don't know. I'm not necessarily a big fan of 4E. I still play, you know, second edition. So,
is that your favored system, I should say?
Oddly enough, XD20 is my favorite system at the moment, because it isn't so cumbersome.
Oh, if you had to pick a D&D edition as your favorite system,
second edition, absolutely. First edition, see, you have to understand how much of an old-timer I am. Mm-hmm. I still have a first edition Dungeon Master's Guide from when it was first released. and that was the game that I learned from.
On Gary's porch, yeah.
Yeah, Gary's original.
Yeah.
And bless him, bless Gary for what he brought to us. That original AD&D manual, the original Dungeon Master's Guide, which came out third. First was the Player's Handbook, and then first was the Monster Manual, then the Player's Handbook, which meant that we had monsters to fight and we had characters that we could play, but we had no rules as to how they interacted. It was an interesting time.
Yeah.
When the Dungeon Master's Guide came out, it was a must-buy. And in fact, I at the time, I used my student loan money to purchase my D&D books, which, incidentally, was the best use that money was put to. And so the original Dungeon Master's Guide it was a terribly difficult read. It was badly organized and kind of went all over the place. And that's kind of why I think people perceived AD&D as something of a cult at the time, because you had to be a really dedicated person to get through that book and make sense out of it. But by the time we got to second edition, you know, hey, we were learning something about organization and the game was making more sense. But it wasn't, you know, and we would lose a few things, weapons versus armor class tables, for example.
Yeah.
But just to streamline play a little bit. But I think that I think the rules have gotten far too cumbersome. I think they get in the way of imagination at this point. When the last edition came out, I can remember flying back from Gen Con convention,
right,
sitting in the aircraft, and across the aisle from me were three young men who had gone to Gen Con, all three of whom had the new edition books, and were poring over them. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know who I was. And I wasn't going to explain it to them.
Yeah.
So I'm overhearing them over there. And one guy, as I got up to get off the aircraft, one of the guys, I heard them on the way down just in the descent. And they were saying, is there any way to make this spell permanent? Do you see any way to make this spell permanent? And as I was getting out of the aircraft, we were waiting, you know, standing in the aisle. I turned to these three guys sitting there and I said, you know, there is a way to make that spell permanent. And all three of them looked up at me and pulled out their books and said, where is it? And I said, there's an entire adventure written about that. And they said, really? Where do we get it? I said, you haven't written it yet.
Yeah, exactly.
And they looked at me like I had flowers in my hair. That I was making fun of them somehow.
Yeah.
And they missed the whole point, which is that this is a game of the imagination. We do not have to be bound by what's between the boards of the book. We're supposed to make stuff up. But I think that we've become so bound in the rules that we have a difficult time doing that anymore. That's one of the reasons, frankly, why we wrote Extreme Dungeon Mastery. Extreme Dungeon Mastery deals with performance. Mm-hmm. It deals with storytelling. It deals with having fun again. You know, for those first games, when I first played D&D, I can still remember my first game and the wonder that was involved in that. And not knowing, you know, if I came around a corner and there were five kobolds, not knowing whether they would kill me or not.
Right.
But it's become all too formalized, I think. And maybe people like the minutiae in that, and I understand that. As a builder and provider of minutia, but where's the fun? That's why we eventually wrote the Extreme Dungeon Mastery.
I think the post 2000 editions brought on the term of laziness with imagination. In my opinion,
yeah, I quite agree. I quite agree, and that's why we wrote this particular system, yeah. which is completely wide open.
I got to take a look.
It is so dependent upon imagination that it frightens people, I think.
It's like a storyteller system, or?
No, it is a traditional RPG system. Mm-hmm. It's an action resolution system. But it is so basic. I mean, one of the secrets that we actually tell in this book, or one of the secrets we say in the book, is that no matter how many charts and tables you add to a system, supposedly, to make it realistic.
Right.
It seems to come down to the fact that you're going to roll a 20-sided die. Mm-hmm. And that means that the level of resolution here can only be in 5% increments.
Okay.
And so anything that you're going to be doing in this game, any attempt that you make, no matter how many charts and tables you sift your way down through, is going to come down to whether you roll a 15 or less.
Hmm.
And so we took that basic concept and just went crazy and said, you know what? Your DM is going to assess the situation, however complicated it is, and is going to assign a number.
Yeah.
And you're going to roll that number or not. And that's what it came down to. And once we blew away all of the complexity and got down to the D20 die and that 5% resolution rate, mm-hmm. suddenly we had a game that just sailed.
Hmm.
It just flew. It's more heavily DM dependent.
Oh, good.
But, hey, how much fun is that?
Loads of fun, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think this actually is the game for you guys. I think this is where you need to go. This is really old school.
We'll have to go see, pick up a copy. I don't know. Maybe Borders sells it.
Borders doesn't sell it.
Oh.
Borders doesn't. They're out of business.
Well, no,
we're not.
We're
not out of business.
That's good.
We're still staying.
Yeah.
Just to let all the listeners know.
If you've got an ebook reader, it's easy to download. You can have it immediately. Or you can order it through the website. And Howard Taylor, who's an online comic book artist, did the comic book art for it. It's fabulous art. Nice. Visit the website, extremedungeonmastery.com. See what it's about. See some of the videos there. And you can pick up the book there. It's a great read.
Okay. Yeah, they're a load of laughs, the XDM. I think when I first saw them was for an online show called Game Geeks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's where I first heard about it, which is also a really good show if anyone is listening and wants to check that out. It's on YouTube, Game Geeks.
I have heard of it.
Oh, yeah. Game Geeks, great. Yeah. So, so what do I play? Yeah, I want to play something that's fun. I'm tired of sifting down through rules.
How about if you had a chance to play Margaret Weiss' system, the Cortex system?
Cortex system?
Yeah.
Yeah, still too complicated for me.
Okay.
Isn't that awful?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have time to read through everybody's rule sets anymore. The only time I have to admit this, though. The only time that I'm reading through big, hairy rule sets, role-playing game rule sets don't appeal to me whatsoever. Oh, yeah. But I'm still a huge fan of the gigantic, ginormous, complicated board game, you know. Yeah. And so I'm a big fan these days of Fantasy Flight and the work that they're doing over there. You know, oddly enough, Wizards of the Coast also sent me a Castle Ravenloft game, which I thought worked out pretty good.
How was that?
Was pretty. Yeah, it's a good game. I like that. It played really well. It probably has way too many cardboard pieces.
Yeah.
That are generally not used except in specific scenarios, which means that you're carrying a lot of cardboard that you don't necessarily need. But it's a beautiful game and it plays really quite well. Z-Man Games, their production of Tales of the Arabian Nights is one of my favorite games. I love that game. That one I'll play a lot, and like I say, just a lot of the really fun games that Fantasy Flight is producing. Their Lord of the Rings Battle for Middle Earth, I think, is a fabulous game if you can figure out how to play it. And we did. We forced our way into it, and we did it. And so many other great stuff. Their Dust is really beautiful and a fun game to play. Just a lot of things that they're doing over there. Their Tide of Iron, for that matter, is really a fabulous war game as well.
Oh yeah.
I just got through. I'm not supposed to tell you this, but I just got through writing a book for Fantasy Flight.
Hmm. Oh well, you just told us.
Oh, but I just did. Oh.
Oh man. Darn.
Yeah, they'll be actually going to be releasing, making the announcement on that here, I believe, next week sometime. And that was a hugely fun product and project. I'm really excited to be working with them on that.
Oh, well, we won't talk any more about that because you're probably under an NDA
We'll come back and tell you about that.
Yeah, you can come back and tell me. going back to the questions, Game Ogre has another one for you. He goes, someone I know of a friend, cried when Tanis died. How could you do that to Tanis? Why, God, why, cry, you killed him, cry.
Yeah, this is from the friend, right?
Yeah, this is from the friend, of course.
Okay.
Sure, friend.
Yeah, the friend, right, that he knows, yeah.
Air quotes.
Why did we kill, why did we kill Tanis? Why did we kill Sturm? Why'd we kill Flint?
I don't know.
Because people die.
Yeah.
And because sometimes that's what's supposed to happen. I think that's part of life, and that we learn as much from that as anything else. Certainly in the case of Sturm's death, Sturm died in the second book that we wrote for Dragonlance. I hesitate saying that because there's always somebody who hasn't read the book. They say, oh, he just what? Oh.
By now, you know.
Yeah. Oh, no. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd think, though, that after, 25 years that somehow it wouldn't be a spoiler. Rosebud's a sled. What can I say? But in fact, Sturm dies in the second book, and his death, however, resonates through every other book since. And people talk about him and honor him and what he did, and so there is a tremendous immortality in that and a tremendous lesson in that, in that character's death. And for that matter, in Flint's character's death as well. Mm-hmm. So why did we kill Danis? Because it was time. And because that's a part of life. It's organic. You can't, you know, no matter how much you want, the story has to be what it is, and it has to be organic. You can't force characters to say things that they wouldn't otherwise say or do things that they wouldn't otherwise do, because it loses the natural story when you do that, and it feels forced and wrong. So, yeah, maybe that's why Tannis died.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of cruel to say he died for story, but there you go.
Okay.
But it makes the story more interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and it makes the story more real. It makes the story feel natural, which a story must, or it communicates nothing.
All right, so I've got one from Havard from the Dragon's Foot forums again. Mm. He says, I'd love to hear more about Rehaja. What was the inspiration for the character Elias? Was there more to him than what was revealed in the module? Then I have a follow-up about the building of... what is the correct pronunciation of the module's name?
Well, first of all, whatever you think it is what it is.
You know us geeks.
I know. Everybody wants to know the correct way of saying things. And I can at least tell you that Rahasia is the correct spelling for that module. Rahasia, if you prefer.
Okay.
It's actually an Indonesian word, and it means secret.
I noticed a lot with the naming conventions in that module that it had kind of a very mid to like a Far East kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. And that was a reflection, I think, of the fact that I was a missionary in Java. You know, and the only real language, the only language I speak with any kind of fluency at all other than English is Indonesian, which is not something I get to use very often, I have to admit. But it is certainly a tremendous resource in terms of magical names and magical phrases, especially because of the linguistic construction of the language, which is in and of itself an entire other story. But Rahasia originally came about. It was the first adventure module that we wrote. We wrote it as something we called Night Ventures because what we wanted, first of all, was a simple adventure that you could play, we thought, in a single night. Something short and self-contained, actually, was probably more accurate, our concept. That we wanted something that was self-contained, that was relatively short, and that told a story. Because one of the first things that we realized when we came into Dungeons & Dragons was... in those days, that it was all about go in, beat up the monster, take his treasure, use the treasure to buy bigger weapons and beat up bigger stuff. And that was essentially as high a plateau of ideology as adventures seemed to portray at the time. And we thought that games would be a great way of telling story. And so we created Rahasia as a storytelling adventure. And it was the first attempt to make a storytelling adventure. And this was something that my wife and I developed. It was, in fact, when we came to TSR and when I first approached TSR with Rahasia and with Pharaoh afterward, the idea of telling story in game was new and unique to what we were proposing to do. And I think in part why they hired us. And so we brought the concept of storytelling into role-playing games, and we're where it came from. And ever since then, we came out with Ravenloft, which we also developed before we came to TSR and brought in as an unfinished product, and sold them as an unfinished product when we came in. Ravenloft was, I think, probably our final iteration of storytelling in games that really set off the whole concept that a game does need to tell a story, especially in a role-playing setting.
And it's nice to be able to thank someone for my style of like writing adventures then.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me. We had no idea at the time that we were starting a trend. We just wanted to play a game that made sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly how I approach my my game worlds and stuff like that. Is when I'm sitting down for like a dungeon, what's the deal with this place, and like what extra things can I add in to make it real and to kind of make it dynamic and flow?
Yeah,
well, exactly. Whenever I watch a movie and I see a ruin portrayed in a movie, you know, my first thought is, I wonder why they built that.
Yeah,
and who built that? And why is it a ruin? Why aren't they still here? What happened? And this always goes through my mind whenever I see something like that in a movie. And it also goes through my mind whenever I'm writing. They find the terrible ruin. Really? Why is that here? Why did they build it here? Who built this? Why is it a ruin now? That all has to be there in my head somewhere, or it just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I've gotten out of your writing style how to story before mechanics and to throw a little bit of what the heck in there.
Mm-hmm. I think that works really well.
Yeah, as Chris already knows what my adventure I run for him.
Yeah, and I'm doing that for the adventure I'm running after this.
Oh, cool.
Ah, sweet. Yeah, I wish I were there.
So one thing that, like, not to cut into Havard's question, but that I want to know is, so I read B7.
Yeah.
And the thing that I liked most about it was the story. But then it was also brought up that it was actually a combination of a couple other modules. What was it, the RPGA 1 and 2? Vince?
Yeah, RPGA 1 and 2. Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is I wrote both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the first one was based on Rahasia, which was the first adventure that we had created. But the second part of it, the B2 part of the adventure, was actually the first adventure I designed.
Hmm.
The floor plan was actually the first adventure I designed that was adapted into that module. And and originally, that part of the adventure was created supposedly as the first couple of levels of Orthanc in Lord of the Rings. And yet, let's go ahead and adapt. So we did. Right along with my theory that you never waste anything, that everything that you create or design eventually finds some use somewhere.
Yep. So what I wanted to know was, how different was Rahasia before you guys got picked up and it got reprinted by TSR?
Well, there are copies of it that are available.
Oh.
Although at exorbitant prices, I wish I had a few.
Yeah.
Actually, I do. I have a copy of the original Rahasia and a copy of the original Pharaoh, both of which do brisk business apparently on the collector's market these days.
Yes.
But I don't notice that it's all that much different. I think that all I did was create links in the second level to link it to the other design, and that for the most part it remained intact. The story, I think, we had to extend. Just because of the nature of marrying those modules. But I think it's pretty much intact.
Hmm.
At least that's my recollection of it.
How do you split up the duties of writing things with Laura? How do you decide to do that? You write out half this, she writes out half that. How does that work?
Well, yeah, sometimes people will ask that, and my answer is I do all the adjectives. but that's just not true. We actually had to work out how we wrote together.
Yeah.
And how we write together works really well for us. Doesn't work necessarily for everyone, but it works well for us. We decided at the beginning of a project which of us is going to be the wordsmith and which of us is going to be the guardian. And we actually have these titles for each other. The wordsmith is the one who actually writes the text. And it's important that one person do that so that the voice of the text remains consistent throughout. So some people I know like to write, you write the first chapter, I'll write two chapters, then you write another chapter. I find that when that happens, that the voice of the text jumps. Mm-hmm. And that's the voice that you hear in your head when you read it.
Right.
And so we like to have one person do the text. In our Eventide book project last year, for example, I was the wordsmith, and so I wrote the actual text. Laura was the guardian, and her job was to go through the text, change it, you know, suggest changes, point out problems in the text, and we would discuss the plot and the characters, of course, as we went along, and then I would write that. then after she goes through her edit, then it comes back to me, and then if there's any questions, we'll talk about it, but I'll do a rewrite based on her edit. And usually by that point, we're pretty close. That's what works best for us. And we talk all the time.
Do you have, when you sit down to write, do you have like a storyboard type thing going, or just notes here and there and ideas here and there?
Well, actually, we like to use an outline, but as we tell people in our writing seminars... Well, as we tell people in the writing seminars, an outline is something that should be held onto like a handful of marbles. If you hang onto the outline too tightly, you're squeezing the marbles too tightly, they start flying out all over and you lose your marbles. If you open your hand and you just, you know, don't hold onto the outline at all, the form, the structure of the story, then the marbles roll off your hand and you lose your marbles there. What you have to do is you have to hang onto an outline like you hold onto a handful of marbles, which is a firm shape, a structure that's in the outline. But then you have to let the characters and the events and the dialogue settle naturally into that form. And allow them the freedom to settle naturally into that form. We talk a lot about organic writing and how your characters and situations need to be organic. And that's I think, the best advice in terms of what we do. We certainly produce an outline, and we usually actually go as far as a chapter outline. Right. There's lots of different ways that you can do that. You can do a beat chart. You can do a classic kind of an outline, a hierarchical outline, if that helps you, whatever works for you. But once you have this outline, you begin writing, you need to hang on to that as a handful of marbles. You need to let your characters explore that just a little bit and settle naturally into the form of the story, the structure of the story, rather than try to force them into your preconception of it. So a lot of times in the writing, the characters will take you places and introduce ideas to you that you had not expected would be there. And that's why you have to follow that a little bit. But at the same time, the characters need to stay within the structure of the story that you've created, because otherwise it loses focus, it loses its force in the writing.
Yeah, I've always done, being someone that comes from film school, I've always done a storyboard, draw up and write ideas that way. I have to check out some of your seminar classes to get some more ideas for writing. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, we're actually opening our first online writing courses begin next month, in the middle of the month next month, and you can find those at scribesforge.com.
Scribesforge.com.
Okay. Do you guys do show notes with your podcast?
Yes,
we do.
Excellent. That being the case, I will actually offer your listeners a discount.
Oh, wow.
On our ScribesForge seminars, and also, for that matter, on our upcoming book that we're doing this summer, our Blackshore book that we're doing this summer, as a serial novel. Last year we did Eventide as a serial novel, and it was a tremendous success. And we're doing another book now in that Dragon's Bard series, Blackshore, which is our pirate book. And we're producing that this summer as a serial novel. At the end of which, of course, we send everybody a hardback limited edition copy from our private printing.
Oh, wow.
Every subscriber gets a private printing book.
Where do I sign up for that?
I'm sorry?
Where do I sign up for that?
Oh, yeah, if you come to dragonsbard.com,
okay.
Then you can learn all about how we do this online serial novel and how you can subscribe to the upcoming novel. We have a few copies of last year's novel that are still available as well.
Awesome.
And we even have a deal right now that we're offering where you can purchase both the first novel and a subscription to the second novel, which is actually a smoking deal if you can avail yourself of that one. But if you come to dragonsbard.com for the book subscription book series, or if you want to learn how to do a subscription book series and learn everything that we have learned over the last 30 years of writing fantasy and speculative fiction, you can come to scribesforge.com and enroll in our online writing courses that we're doing there starting next month. We have video seminars that we present each week there. We have forums there for the discussion of the principles that we discuss with you every week. And I monitor and administrate those forums personally. So it's a very hands-on thing. We've been doing this for 30 years, and we think it's time now that we pass on the craft that we have learned to a new generation of writers, especially in this new media age. Especially in this new media age. So what I would recommend, actually, best of all, would be to come to the show, look at the show notes here for your show, and we will actually provide you there in the show notes a discount, a coupon. On the writing seminars, and we'll also give you a discount on book subscriptions as well. In fact, we'll be a nice guy, and we'll give you a 20% discount.
Could you just repeat that coupon? Did you say a code? Because Skype actually dropped down on us for a second.
Yes, we're going to do we will be nice people, and we will provide you in the show notes a coupon code.
Okay.
That you can use on either the DragonsBard.com site or the ScribesForge site. ScribesForge.com site for a 20% discount.
Wow.
Off of any product there.
That's amazing. Thank you.
And this comes directly from me. This is straight from me.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, glad to. It'd be great to have everybody come. And like I say, we want to pass on this craft. We think it's time for a new voice of writers to come forward and to tell the stories that they have to tell.
Did a good job with the site. I'm looking at the ScribesForge site. Excellent design.
Oh, thank you. I did that myself.
I really like the background. Definitely love the background.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we have people who started subscribing now and getting set. We're launching on March 15th, it's a six week course. But we provide. We provide access to the workshops for 6 months so that after you've gone through the course, you'll have recourse not only to ask me questions and Laura questions there, but also to the other good workshop people that are going to be there that are going to help get everybody. We're going to get everyone read.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually the first principle that we teach in our workshops. Everybody wants to get published. But the truth is that anybody can be published today. Anybody who writes a blog considers themselves published. Anybody who has a word processor and can access Amazon.com can set themselves up as an ebook publisher.
Or Lulu Press, for that matter, too.
They'll be more than happy to set you up to get your books ready to go and do it as print on demand.
Yeah.
That's not what makes an author.
Selling.
Yeah, it's not a question of whether you're published. It's a question as to whether you're read.
Yeah.
Because the written word does not live until it is read by someone. We talk about this actually during our seminars as to the critical partnership between the writer and the reader. And that the actual event takes place in the reader's mind, not the writer's. So having your words read is the objective. Not just being published. Anybody can be published. In fact, you know, Vanity Press, you've always been able to be published. You can go and give anybody enough money and they'll be happy to fill your garage full of books. The point that we want to emphasize in our writing seminars is not getting people published. What we want to emphasize is how do you get read? How do you create a story that people will pay money to read, that value it that much? How do you create a story that is that valuable? And that's the emphasis of our seminars. We're not here to get you published. We're here to help you build a career. And that, I think, is a far more important thing for writers today. And whether that's game designers or whether that's novelists, I think that's the critical question mark and the thing that we want to help people develop.
Wow. So if you're offering a 20% discount to signing up for the, level 100 course?
We have the level 100 course, and we have the 101 course, and we have the 102 course.
Yes.
Yeah, the 101 course is the seminars, the online seminars, which you'll be able to see and learn from. And it also provides access to the general forums there and workshop forums that we'll set up for you there. The 102 course is the 101 course is the seminar course. The 102 course is the workshop course, and that course, I will read your pages, and I will give you my critique of your pages, and you can discuss them with me directly. And that's limited to 25 people at a time because I've only got so much time that I can, you know, put toward this.
I don't know. I'd be too nervous to write a paper and hand it to you or Laura. I'd be like, oh.
Oh, you know, though, the wonderful thing about that is that no one will know except you and me.
I know, but still.
But that's the great thing. I tell people I love editors who buy ink by the gallon.
Yeah.
Red ink, especially by the gallon, because when they're done bleeding on my manuscript, it will be polished, and it will be worthwhile. And that means that when it finally does see print, only my editor is going to know what a lousy writer I am. And that's important to me because, again, being read is what's important, not being published. And if I want my words to go out there in the possible best way so that it communicates the story in the best way possible. And so, yeah, if people within the work group workshops, you know, really are banging your book around, it's polish. And by the time you come out of that, if your manuscript is now ready to be seen by somebody in the industry and to be read by somebody online and say, "Wow, that's a good story," oh yeah, that's worth taking the knocks. The interesting thing for us has been that the response so far has been largely toward the 101 workshop or the 102 workshops.
Yeah.
The actual workshops as opposed to the seminars. And that's very heartening for me. That means people are serious about learning this craft.
Definitely. Okay. And last question to wrap things up. What was your involvement with the Dragonlance movie, and will there be any more movies of the anime coming out?
We actually were asked to participate with the Dragonlance movie, and it was actually wonderful to do so. We really enjoyed doing it. I think I've been on record as saying that it is the Dragonlance movie is probably the best radio play ever done on DVD. If you sit with your back to the television,
yeah,
it's a fabulous experience.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. The sound quality is tremendous. The music is Oscar worthy. If you listen to the music, and if you've had a chance to listen to the music soundtrack, it is some of the most beautiful cinematic music that you've ever heard. The voice talents were tremendous.
Oh yeah, great actors and actresses.
Great actors and actresses. The script I thought was tremendous. I thought it was given the constraints that they were under in writing it, I thought they did it. The script was a tremendous rendition of the story. And but the animation just wasn't there.
It just wasn't
visually what it used to be. And you know, people have asked me about that since, and my response usually has actually been that Lord of the Rings was originally a Ralph Bakshi film.
Yeah.
And so I actually have hopes, actually, that in the future we will see a Dragonlance film that will do justice to it visually as well as in the audio category. But we did it. Yeah, we had a lot of involvement in that. One of my great memories, in fact, is going to Los Angeles and listening to the music beds being laid down with the Prague Orchestra. What a tremendous experience that was.
Cool. Now, I heard about one of the voice actors, Keith Sutherland, that it was you had some trouble getting him, and then when you finally got in contact with him, he was more than happy to do it, and he dove into it like head first, and he really got into the character by asking for all the books, and he really studied. Is this true, that rumor?
That is absolutely true, yeah, absolutely true.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not like you can just look up Kiefer in the phone book and you know, call him up or stop by his house. But when they did find him, yeah, he said, "Yeah, I know that. Yeah, I can do that." And he was very excited to do something along those lines. And he provided tremendous talent and depth, I think, to what we did.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, thank you for sitting down with us this time and chatting with us about your past. And
definitely.
We have to get you back on some other time to answer some more questions.
I'd love to come back, and there are many more stories to tell, and I'd love to talk about that. Whenever you're ready, by all means, let me know. We've got those writing seminars next month, so it'd be kind of fun to talk about how those went and how those are going. So just anytime you want me back, I'd be happy to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. Have a good night, everybody.
If you have any comments, please email saveordiepodcast@gmail.com or visit saveordie at saveordie.info. Follow the cast on Facebook / saveordiepodcast or follow them on Twitter @TheEvilDM.